This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, we'll talk about why the assassination continues to enthrall and horrify us. Also, what would have happened had Kennedy lived? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gabfest, the death of an adjunct professor at Duquesne University became a cause celeb for underpaid academics, but there's more to the story than you might have heard. And then Dallas Buyers Club, a new movie about the early days of the AIDS epidemic.
This is my patient. You treating these people?
Oh, they're treating themselves.
With what?
Vitamins, peptide T, DVC, anything but that poison you're hawking.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz, live at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We'll talk about why that event remains searing for so many Americans. Then, what would have happened had Kennedy lived? Joining me on the Bell House stage is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hi, David.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
So on November 22nd, 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. The images and sounds of that day and the days to follow are still vivid memories for many Americans, including those of us who weren't even born. What's amazing is how resonant they are for people who weren't alive to see it or were too young to remember it. Cronkite announcing the death, Jackie Kennedy in her blood-stained pink, what do we call it, her pink suit. Her pink suit, yeah, that's the word, her suit, stepping down from Air Force One with the coffin bearing the president, Lyndon Johnson taking the oath of office, that photo of him, the famous photo of him taking the oath of office on Air Force One. And perhaps the most remarkable and tragic photo of little John Kennedy, saluting his father's coffin. So why is it that this event has haunted America for so long, and why this family obsessed America for so long?
Because Kennedy was assassinated so early in his presidency, 3 years in, he stands for infinite possibility. And that's inherently exciting.
Meaning he didn't do anything?
Meaning he did a few things, but he could have done more, and we don't know what he would have done. And our image of him, our romantic Camelot image, isn't so tarnished, especially by the second term, which we know is a problem.
I thought you meant he's frozen at the height of his appeal. I mean, he's always frozen as that guy running around with his kids. He's frozen looking romantic and full of vigor, and all the stuff that we know now about him.
I think you meant
is all the stuff we know now about him, about his health, about the womanizing, about the lying. You know, we didn't know that at the time, and it almost feels like those are separate. Those are about a separate person than the television image. I mean, it's also generational. So, you know, for one generation, this was the first, you know, for the post-World War II generation, this was a new era. This was, I mean, you had Eisenhower, the oldest living president up to that time, and now you then had Kennedy, the youngest president ever to take office. And that break, there was a whole generation that came along with Kennedy that was trained by television and then experienced this national moment together that lives on long after he did.
But what's funny is that Kennedy as a politician actually is an Eisenhower. He's much more Eisenhower in the policies he's pursuing, in his interests, in how he goes about things. In, you know, he's a very neat, buttoned-up person. He's not a politician of the 60s. He's a politician of the 50s who just happens to be younger.
But isn't the fact that he was younger and yet had so much of that more 50s conventionality exactly why he was the bridge and why he was able to appeal to older voters but also somehow represent the future at the same time?
Right, and he's not the 60s of the youth culture of the 60s. He's the 60s of their parents. I mean, or slightly a little bit older, but the World War II generation versus the like late 60s. He wouldn't have been a part of that.
He might have seemed to be completely out of sync with the late 60s, but we'd never had to go through that and watch him age ungracefully if that would have happened. And so he's frozen, as you were saying, and he's also remains this vessel we can invest an incredible amount of hope in.
What I hadn't realized until I started doing this reading is just how much of this legacy is manufactured by Jackie Kennedy, the fact that she stages a funeral at the White House to look like Lincoln's funeral. She explicitly asks that it look like Lincoln's funeral, or the Camelot, this idea of Camelot, which becomes the defining metaphor about the Kennedy administration in the mid-late 60s, is something that she invents, gives to Teddy White, the kind of house historian of the Kennedys, to pass on. The Camelot is not something anyone said about the administration while it was in office.
It's funny because he's both the television president, which means a much more public presidency than before, but he also is the last one who can, where they can shape that story. Nixon, if Nixon ruins the presidency and changes it and breaks it in a way in its relationship with the country, Johnson does a pretty good job of that too. I mean, the cries about the lies that LBJ told change the relationship between the country and their president in a way that seems a lot different than Kennedy. So he's both a new kind of a thing, but he also...
He's still wrapped in the bubble, in the cocoon.
Right, exactly. And so that's a way in which... Also, by the way, his presidency was incredibly interesting and full of like dramatic moments before he's even killed. So there's all this stuff that was about his life as a president that's interesting that doesn't have anything to do with his being killed. That's a part of, I think, people's connection with him.
If Robert Kennedy isn't killed, if Teddy Kennedy doesn't have this star-crossed career in politics, if little John Kennedy doesn't die in this terrible plane accident, does the Kennedy legacy have the same hold over us? How much of the Kennedy mythos is this notion that this family is particularly glorious and yet cursed and thus has this kind of Shakespearean connection to us?
I mean, it could have a different hold if Bobby Kennedy had been So imagine one of those other figures had been elected president and had successfully served. We wouldn't have the sense of curse, but we might still have the sense that this family has helped sustain American politics, that our fascination with them is multi-generational.
How many people here believe there's doubt about whether Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin?
Ask about Jack Ruby, too.
Wait. Lone assassin or lone wolf? In other words, the only person that day actively engaged in trying to kill him?
I just thought of that question on the spur of the moment. I didn't, like, clarify it.
You want to ask your variation?
You can ask
it
again if you want.
So there are three things, right? There's was he just acting by himself? As just a dude with a grievance? Was he acting as the shooter for a larger conspiracy? Or were there other shooters that day? So the conspiracy was much more involved than that.
So one is lone wolf, nothing to do with anyone.
No.
Two is a lone sniper, but part of a conspiracy. Three is there are shooters everywhere. You people are just saying that. You don't actually believe that. You're just doing it to make noise. Okay.
It does sound like the best choice, though.
So why is the assassination been so obsessional for people?
Because there are all these mess-ups along the way. Because the wrong doctors did the autopsy. Because the Warren Commission didn't have access to lots of CIA documents about the time Oswald spent in the Cuban consulate in Mexico. Because there are all these reasons to doubt. In the end, it doesn't add up to anything. And now I'm channeling my friend Beverly Gage, who's a historian at Yale, that you could argue that it should have been a conspiracy, that given all the ways in which Kennedy was, you know, involved with the mob, messing around in the Cold War, planning to assassinate Fidel Castro, that in fact there would be some larger truth about the era, a story you could tell that would end in the U.S., in the Soviets recruiting exactly someone like Oswald to carry out this assassination. It just doesn't happen to be true, but it would actually fit.
Right. Well, also, it's not just the Soviets. So, I mean, Kennedy thought, what's amazing what he had to deal with. He comes into office, has a huge screw-up on the Bay of Pigs, then has this really messed-up relationship with Khrushchev, and then he has to sort of deal both with trying to think through what Khrushchev is thinking about, but then he's also got all of his military advisors suggesting new and exciting ways to get involved in a massive thermonuclear war. And so the biggest challenge of the Cuban Missile Crisis seems to be keeping his own team from blundering into a war. And so in that context, Thurston Clark's book talks a lot about how he was worried about a coup from his own military advisors. So you have the Cubans wanted to kill him because Bobby Kennedy was actively, through Operation Mongoose, trying to find ways to kill Fidel Castro. They were worried about his own military having a coup, and then there would be the Soviets as well.
What is it about the conspiracy that satisfies a need? What is it that Americans want? Meaning. Why do we want that conspiracy?
Meaning.
What is it that satisfies us with it?
It gives purpose and direction and meaning, even though it might be depressing, to something that otherwise seems totally existentially chaotic and just like your world can be ruling along, and suddenly, boom, he's shot dead.
Also, do you think the assassination is a way of channeling all the later dispiriting things we learn about Kennedy, that he had Addison's and hid it, that there were all these deceptions and lies about his affairs, that he had ties to the mob that are discomforting, that instead of tarnishing his image, because we know he's still incredibly popular, right? In your piece, I think you said 74% of Americans see him as a good to outstanding president.
Right, yeah.
Hugely high, right. One of the top ratings. So we have the assassination as this set of questions that we struggle with. And so instead of taking the bad news about Kennedy and actually having it affect this incredibly telegenic, young Camelot, right, King Arthur, it gets caught up in all the assassination business.
So all our bad thoughts we channel to
the assassination.
The assassination. Yeah. It bears the sins.
Right, maybe. Of the man.
I mean, it is striking that he was so popular at the after. I mean, this is what interests me, is that the Bay of Pigs was a huge disaster. Can you imagine if an American president right now launched an invasion or was responsible for launching an invasion on another country?
It didn't go well.
I can't.
Could that happen?
No, but, I mean, Saddam's not still in power. That's the difference. I mean, within 2 days,
awry.
It goes so awry that basically the guy is still in power and, in fact, arguably is still in power.
But don't you feel like the Cuban Missile Crisis kind of made, I mean, I don't. I have,
well, no, it did, but that was a long way between that.
I see.
And in between that, he then goes to Vienna, and that's a total disaster. And yet his approval ratings and his numbers before the Cuban Missile Crisis are still high. People think he's great.
And is that simply because he and his family are so beautiful and lovely and on every magazine cover?
I mean, he had certainly, incredible enemies of Kennedy, and there were plenty of people, I mean, including Eisenhower, and there were, you know, Republicans who didn't like him and so forth. But there was more of a tolerance for, there was just kind of more receptivity to when things went wrong with presidencies.
Coming up, would JFK have stopped the Vietnam War if he'd lived? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
What would have happened had John F. Kennedy not been assassinated in Dallas? The journalist Jeff Greenfield wrote an interesting book that just came out. It's called If Kennedy Lived, which proposes a counterfactual history. Kennedy's not assassinated because the weather in Dallas is not quite as nice as it turned out to be. He puts the bubble on the limousine, and he is not assassinated. Oswald's bullets are shot, but don't kill him, and Greenfield's telling of it. It's a really interesting experiment in thinking. It got us wondering how much of what we imagine to be sort of the certainties of history are dependent on this event. Would we have had a civil rights legislation the same way had Kennedy not been killed? Would the nation's trauma, the kind of trauma of assassinations that we went through in the 60s, have happened without it? Would the 60s have unfolded differently in terms of the rise of a youth counterculture in opposition to the Vietnam War? And I think probably the biggest question is, the Vietnam War fought in the same way if Kennedy lives? So, is the Vietnam War fought in the same way if Kennedy lives?
the moment, I reserve the right to change this in 5 minutes. No, I mean, what's striking is that...
Yes! Go ahead. I mean, go. Let's do it. Go ahead. All right. You're wrong, but let's discuss.
So one of the things that's striking about Kennedy's, both when he opens the back channel to Khrushchev, when he gives the American University speech in which he talks about the United States having, you know, the children breathing the same air as the Soviets, and everything that he does with respect to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which at the time looks like the president staring down the mean old Russians and is a huge boon for him, because nobody knows about basically deciding to remove the missiles from Turkey as a basically quid pro quo for removing them from Cuba. And, by the way, his strong distrust of his military, which builds and builds and builds, starts with the Bay of Pigs, but then just every week seems to get worse, particularly around Vietnam, in which he's getting advice about basically just using nuclear weapons in Vietnam. So he's constantly got his back up against the wall, worried about the over-aggressiveness of his military advisors. What the Cuban Missile Crisis allows him to do is basically have credibility on the communism question. He's tough enough to stare down the Russians. He's beat back the worry that he's too weak on Cuba that came up after the Bay of Pigs, and therefore is not pushed as much into Vietnam as Johnson was. Johnson comes into office, doesn't have the cred from the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution and his response to it is an attempt to show that he is going to be just as tough on those communists, and that leads him down a path that was already started under Kennedy, but his incentives, which have largely to do with domestic politics, are much more to be more hawkish than they are for Kennedy.
It's very easy to see this retrospectively because you see what an incredible disaster Vietnam becomes.
And so you assume that Kennedy would have seen that ahead of time in a way that Johnson didn't?
Yeah, you assume, you know that, like, somehow, because Kennedy he has more experience of war than Johnson did, so he was somebody who fought a war, so he may know better, and maybe he's more skeptical of generals than Johnson would have, that he would have identified earlier that this is a fiasco, that we're not winning this war and we'll get out. But that only presumes that you can see to the future and know that this is a war that is going to squander national treasure.
Well, except that
the pressure in the United States in the 60s is not to retreat from communism, and the domino theory is very much alive and well, and it's alive and well among Kennedy's advisors, even in the early 60s. They haven't surrendered on that yet.
But, I mean, in Dalek's recent book about the debates over Vietnam, it's clear from the tapes that Kennedy had that he was getting advice and was favoring the advice of people who were saying, look, once you get into this, it's going to spiral, it's going to be unstoppable, it's going to be out of control. I mean, it's amazing, these quotes. And he kept seeking the advice of people who were going down that road. He wasn't going to Rusk and saying, okay, tell me more times how we can get involved in this. Internally, in the internal debates, people were saying this is going to be a disaster. This is going to be, you know, 10 years of fighting and we'll be just like the French. Remember, he goes to talk to de Gaulle about Vietnam and basically gets the book on Vietnam, which is you'll spend all this money, blood, and treasure. You won't do anything to change the minds of the people. They'll always see you as colonialists and you're not going to win. So De Gaulle, because he
would have been in a position that Johnson wouldn't have been to actually...
Because he had cred and because, remember, he believes in the great man theory. And so De Gaulle, for him, is like this genius. And so he's listening to De Gaulle, and that's another reason, in addition to the fact that he's listening to the people within his administration.
Right, and then he orders the president of Vietnam assassinated, you know, right before he dies. Which is the opposite of an escalation.
No, it's not, actually. So he believed in sort of what we would have called COIN now, right? Sort of counterinsurgency. So he tried that, which was, let's do a bunch of limited stuff. He tried to send advisors instead of troops, try to win over the people and have a kind of managed war, because rather than Eisenhower's sort of mutually assured destruction, this was a kind of managed war. Well, that was a total disaster. So you kill Diem, you sap the grievances, the reason for grievances. It's like getting rid of Castro. So you kill the head, which keeps you from having to send in hundreds of thousands of troops. It doesn't necessarily follow that if you're trying to assassinate the top guy, that the next step is necessarily going to send 100,000. If you can assassinate him, then you're in good shape because you have this slightly warped view that he's what's blocking democratic, the sort of the flowering of a democracy or flowering of something better than Diem and his crazy brother and weird wife. Right. So I don't know that it necessarily follows.
Okay, you win. Let's move to civil rights. So Emily,
if only we had that recorded.
Emily, I think there are two theories on civil rights. One theory is, oh, Kennedy is moving towards sort of a vigorous endorsement of civil rights legislation. He is going to push it down the throats of the Southern Democrats at the time he dies, and he's going to carry that forward. Another theory is, no, he can't do it. He doesn't have the political strength. It is only his assassination, which, you know, the martyrdom of John F. Kennedy, which allows LBJ to pass civil rights, to pass Medicare, to pass the war on poverty, that the legislation we associate with the kind of great society that LBJ develops is only possible because Kennedy is dead.
And also because of LBJ's ability to manage the Senate and, you know, our romanticization, if that's a funny word to use about LBJ, but we do think of him as the ultimate mastermind of legislative strategy, and we imagine Kennedy didn't have that. So I'm very biased toward this idea because I'm not a Kennedy person.
This idea that what?
That Kennedy wouldn't have done this on his own. That is, he contributed, tragically, his death to this, but obviously not deliberately, and that he didn't, that he, you know, he gave some really good speeches. It's not that he didn't care about civil rights or these other things we're talking about, but that he wasn't committed to this extent, and also that the political calculus would have been against him in a way that it wasn't. I'm partial to that explanation because I'm just not a Kennedy person. The fascination with JFK and with the Kennedys has always kind of mystified me. I resisted a little bit. So, and I tend to see LBJ as a little bit, you know, maligned despite all these accomplishments. And I guess I am taken with this notion that this is the good thing that came out of the assassination, was this moment of truth and awakening for the country.
So what I wonder about you, what you guys think of Kennedy, is that, I mean, he clearly cared more about foreign policy than domestic policy. I mean, he used to say that, you know, domestic policy will hurt you politically, but foreign policy will kill you, you know, if it goes wrong. So that civil rights speech you talk about happens in 1963. He gives it so hastily, he's making it up at the end of the speech. It's not even written. He's just kind of winging it.
And yeah, good speech.
Right. And, you know, constantly he's being, along the way, he's telling the, you know, when the Freedom Riders get blown up, his first reaction is, when their bus gets blown up, his first reaction is to call Harris Wofford and say, tell your friends to stop it. Because he's playing a political game. He knows he can't get the votes of the Southern Democrats. He also is, so the question is, was he a moral coward? Was he didn't really care about it. He cared about other stuff. I mean, he doesn't even mention the bombing in Alabama of the churches. He doesn't mention when he gives his State of the Union. Or was he a guy who basically saw that there was no way this was going to get through in its current situation, and that you have to be smart about when you bring up big, huge, controversial pieces of legislation like this, and you need Democrats to pass it of a certain sort, and so you don't want to do it in a way that helps those people not get elected? Or was he just a guy who was a coward and should have tried to force it through?
I mean, I'm almost always drawn to the pragmatic answer to the question that would essentially give him a pass on this because of the problem with the Southern Democrats and the votes. And yet, for this, I feel unforgiving. And then to second guess, then the other side, it's only in retrospect that we are so clear about the morality. I mean, you know, there were lots of people who were not utterly moved by what we now see as this incredibly stark injustice. Huh. There was a lot more indifference. No.
Well, there was indifference, but that doesn't, I mean,
it doesn't excuse it.
It doesn't
be great.
It
to be great is presumably he would have been the guy to cut through the indifference, right? That would be greatness.
This is
to
a
be
big
able
problem
to see
for his great man, yeah, great person. Yeah.
And also when he calls, you know, he calls Coretta King during his 1960 election when Martin Luther King's put in jail. And so that got him a lot of votes in the African American community, but is basically like
symbolic.
Totally. Well, yeah. I mean, he wanted the votes.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Brooklyn. The Culture Gabfest starts now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, the new movie Dallas Buyers Club. It stars Matthew McConaughey as a man heroically fighting his own HIV and the medical establishment. And then the death of an adjunct professor. Is it really the morality tale it's been taken for? We'll discuss with Slate's own Laura Anderson. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steven.
Dallas Buyers Club tells the story of Ron Woodruff, a Texas good old boy rodeo rider who, after being diagnosed with HIV in the mid-1980s, began aggressively self-medicating And after surviving the 30-day death sentence given to him by traditional doctors, he created a buyer's club to help others suffering from the virus to obtain black market and gray market medications. The film, I should say, is directed by Jean-Marc Vallée. I hope Dana can tell me who that is exactly. And it stars Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto. All right, well, before we dig in, why don't we start with a clip? Julia, do you want to set this one up?
Yes. So what we're hearing in this clip will be Matthew McConaughey, who has tried to smuggle a bunch of drugs into the country for his clients, members of the Dallas Buyers Club, and he's been stopped and intercepted by an FDA agent. So this is their confrontation.
Walker, Dorsett, Blunt, Newsom, Jeffcoat. These are patients?
Yes, sir.
They're also the names of players on the Dallas Cowboys.
That's a hell of a coincidence, isn't it?
Isn't this a little ridiculous?
Well, you said it.
Can you prove these are patients?
Can you prove they're not?
In answer to your question, Steve, Jean-Marc Vallée is a French-Canadian director who hasn't done that much before. His previous big credit was The Young Victoria, which is a period piece very different from this movie. And I have to say that Dallas Buyers Club, although I thought I went in knowing what kind of movie this is. It's a movie, for example, in which the lead actor loses, I don't know, 30 pounds, 50 pounds, something like that. We see him slowly wasting away. I thought that it would be sort of a Philadelphia 2, you know, that it would be a movie about AIDS that was made acceptable to the mainstream. Don't get me wrong. I actually think Philadelphia was a really important moment in film history, and I like the film Philadelphia, but it's a dated sort of way, right, of filming AIDS. And this movie slowly won me over by the end. I actually think that it did a fantastic job of telling the kind of story that we don't often hear about a straight man with AIDS, for example, which is a huge part of the movie. The main character struggles with his own homophobia. As the movie starts out, it's made very, very clear in the first scene that he wants no part of that world.
Julia, what do you think of the movie?
I was mesmerized by two of the performances in it. I think Matthew McConaughey is wonderful and has suddenly become one of the most interesting actors in Hollywood against all of the bongo playing odds, right? And then Jared Leto also has a remarkable supporting performance as a trans woman who becomes McConaughey's partner in setting up the Dallas Buyers Club and helping him connect to the world of gay men afflicted with HIV who are his potential clients. And the two of them are mesmerizing, and anytime they're on camera, you can't stop watching. When you broaden out your analysis of the film a bit further to the writing, the overall storyline, what it says about AIDS or anything else, and sadly, the performance of my beloved Jennifer Garner, who I love her from Alias, but oh my God, she's terrible in this movie. I don't think the movie stacks up quite as favorably. So I think it's two remarkable performances that are worth watching in the middle of a movie that's maybe not quite as good as the performances it surrounds. Mm. What did you think, Steve?
You know what? I'm gonna push back on that. I actually think it's a tremendously good movie. I mean, it bordering on a great movie. I mean, in maybe the same category as Milk from a few years ago. First of all, the McConaughey performance, if he doesn't win the Oscar, I'd be shocked. I think it's...
He's got to go up against Chiwetel. He's not going to win.
This year, he's not going to win the Oscar. But he's now in the category of somebody who could be considered. Not to mention Robert Redford from All Is Lost, Tom Hanks from Captain Phillips. It's a pretty tough year for Best Actor.
Okay, so I'm completely wrong. He ought to win it, though, because it's an extraordinary performance, and not just giving absolutely no grade inflation to the fact that it's an unexpected one from Matthew McConaughey. I agree he's emerged as this, you know, truly extraordinary actor, an actor of depth and range, and it's really an incredible performance. What I want to say about it is that I went into the movie thinking it was a kind of naked excuse for an Oscar bid, lose a ton of weight, you know, heavy method acting exercise. I went in quite cynical. My cynicism was melted within 5 minutes. I think it's an extraordinarily well-directed movie. I think this director has control of the camera and pacing as good as any young director I may have ever seen. I think it's true that the narrative of the film trends a little bit in the direction of the movie of the week, a little bit, not a lot. What he's doing as a narrative filmmaker was so controlled and so conscious of the effects that it was producing and working so beautifully with the actors. I really was astonished by it. And I walked away from it, having gone in thinking cynically, this is a naked Oscar bid. I literally wrote down in my notebook, acting maybe the last art form in which a fashionable anti-humanism is not possible. I just think it's such a deeply human movie, carried along by more than just the performances, but also by the director.
You know, there's been some criticism of the Rayon character played by Jared Leto, that he's sort of a tragic drag queen stereotype. I didn't experience that watching the movie, but now I sort of want to see it again with that in mind. Did his character bother you at all?
Brian Lauder had a really interesting post on this subject for Slate on our Outward blog, pointing out that it's fruitless to police narratives that include gay characters and suggest that only the most valorous ones may be represented in quasi-true historical fictions. And I found that very persuasive. I found Leto just mesmerizing and really, truly felt in that role. It didn't, I mean, I think he was certainly enjoying sashaying around the motel where they conduct their business, but it didn't feel showy to me, even though the character himself was a showy character. The performance didn't feel showy.
That's a good way of putting it. Same with McConaughey, actually. His character is completely larger than life, you know, gonzo kind of character, but he actually doesn't give a gonzo performance.
They both feel incredibly truly lived to me, and I found that persuasive. And Steve, you're totally right about the actual direction of the film. The way it cut and skipped from scene to scene was very propulsive and compelling, and I did like that. And I would be interested to see what this director does again. And yet there was still something about the larger film that felt unsatisfying to me. And I hope you guys can help me piece together what it was. Maybe it lies in the writing, but there was something about Ron Woodruff, the character's larger project, and the way the film vilifies the FDA and Big Pharma while valorizing more international efforts that felt somehow oversimplified. That's an amazing and really true story from the history of AIDS that's remarkable and fascinating and troubling, and I think has troubling consequences for how we think about pharmaceutical approvals now. But something about that element of this story felt sort of paper thin and unpersuasive to me.
Julia, if I was going to try to put words in your mouth to help you figure out that lacking element, I think I would suggest that it has something to do with the larger context of AIDS activism and kind of the place of, I mean, Ronald Reagan doesn't really appear in the movie not as a character for sure, but I mean, even sort of as a specter. There's not really a sense of where we were at as a country in terms of dealing with AIDS. So I think maybe part of the problem, and this goes back also to the conventionality of the story, is that it's a melodrama, a very successful and powerful melodrama, about one man's sort of conversion, one man's transformation, right? But it's not necessarily put in the context of a larger social transformation.
And so the world in which that transformation happens feels thin. It's sort of like an incredibly, I think that's what I was trying to say at the beginning. It's these incredibly compelling performances, but the backdrop feels, you know, like the scrim behind the second grade play, like you get the bare outlines.
And in that sense, it is a little bit like Philadelphia, I think, and powerful in some of the same ways.
Now, I'm going to completely disagree with you both on this. I thought it would have felt like a movie of the week if you had had the obligatory shot of Ronald Reagan on the screen saying something duncey. And, you know, there's a little bit about Rock Hudson, because Rock Hudson was the way in which people, you know, certain portions of America came to know and understand this disease. There's a tiny bit of that.
In fact, the movie contains an image of Rock Hudson's face in the newspaper announcing that he's died of AIDS.
Yeah. And to me, what they did do is they put it on exactly the right size canvas. And within that canvas, you see the long lines of people showing up at the seedy Dallas Buyers Club. And you see that these people have a death sentence etched, what they believe to be a death sentence etched on their face. So I thought they were painterly touches that were quite effective and gave a sense of the depth and extent of the crisis.
Okay, but can you at least agree with me, Steve, that Jennifer Garner is no good in this movie?
Yeah, not a big Jay Garn fan. I don't think it was. She didn't bring the chops to this.
Jay Garn. I would maybe submit that there is not a Jay Garn filmic performance that stands out as superior to this one.
I know. Maybe nobody cares that she's bad in this movie because you guys just expect her to be bad in everything. But as Alias, the wonderful spy show that she starred in, that was like her first role, that was also the show that helped J.J. Abrams make his name as a creator of compelling thrillers. She's so good in it, and she's like this spy, but she's just a girl at heart, and all of those cute face scrunches that she does seem totally apropos to her faux J.J. Abrams spy world. But then she was using the exact same face muscles in this movie. And so you have these incredibly deep, deft, subtle, thrilling performances from McConaughey and Leto, and then they're both having these heart-to-hearts with Jay Garn, and she's giving this like romantic comedy eyebrow scrunch, like, oh, AIDS. It's just the
so
worst.
Icky.
Oh, it made me so sad because I'm rooting for Jay Garn, but oh, this is not her best role.
All right. Well, the movie is called The Dallas Buyers Club. It stars Matthew McConaughey and Jay Garn. Go see it. Tell us what you think of their performances. You can do that on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/culturefest. Coming up, what can we learn from the life and death of an adjunct professor? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner. And this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on. On Friday, August 16th, Margaret Mary Voichko, an adjunct French professor who recently lost her job at Duquesne University at the age of 83, suffered a heart attack on a street corner in Homestead, Pennsylvania. Voichko collapsed yards from the house where she had lived almost her entire life. She was rushed to the hospital. She never regained consciousness. And on Sunday, September 1st, she died. So writes Laura Anderson, an assistant editor and contributor to Slate magazine. She goes on to say in her riveting piece, 2.5 weeks later, Voichko's lawyer, Daniel Kovalik, published an op-ed about her called Death of an Adjunct. Kovalik wrote that, unlike a well-paid tenured professor, Margaret Mary worked on a contract basis from semester to semester with no job security, no benefits, and with a salary of $3,000 to $3,500 per three-credit course. This story, Laura, as you point out, was picked up by the media at large. This is a story rich with symbolism and pathos, but maybe it's not precisely the morality tale that the media has made it out to be.
Right. I think that this story caught on because there are so many people now working in academia in contract positions with no job security, making very little money. And this was a story that seemed to symbolize everything that's wrong with the economics of higher education. You have an elderly woman who is apparently living in poverty, so much so that she could no longer live in her home. According to the original op-ed, that was because she couldn't afford to heat her home. And she had just lost her job after teaching at Duquesne for 25 years. There was a sense of outrage that someone could work, devote their life to an institution for 25 years and then sort of be let go without, you know, so much as a goodbye party. So I think that the story caught on in part because there are so many adjuncts now and this who want to be heard. I think this is a debate that is talked about a lot in the world of higher education, not necessarily so much outside of it. And here was a story that had a lot of resonance with a lot of people.
And that even spawned a Twitter hashtag, right?
Absolutely. It spawned a Twitter hashtag, I am Margaret Mary, that people were using, grad students, adjuncts, people who used to be adjuncts, about how horrible working conditions are for adjuncts really across the country.
And I should say that your piece in no way is an attempt to mitigate that outrage or complicate the politics of hiring adjuncts. It's really about what this individual's story really was. And it was way more complex and layered than it's been taken to be.
Right. Absolutely. And that, I think, is almost obvious. Like the story that went viral was maybe like 800 words or 1,000 words. Of course, the story was more complicated than that story. And I think even the story that went viral had hints of what was complicated about this story. According to the popular version, this woman, Professor Voichko, suffered a heart attack after receiving a letter from Adult Protective Services saying that a caseworker wanted to meet with her. And, you know, when I first read that, I thought, well, isn't that how the system is supposed to work? It seems great that, okay, you have local governmental agencies looking into a person who appears to be sort of on the verge of maybe falling through the cracks. And so it seems like, okay, this is the system working. But as it turns out, the reason that Professor Voichko was so anxious about meeting with a caseworker, or one of the reasons, I mean, I don't want to sort of simplify it too much, but one of the reasons is that she hoarded. Her house was completely full of stuff. This was one reason that she was unable to have her house heated, because she was unwilling to have anyone enter her house because she was afraid of having her belongings moved or touched, or, you know, having a forced clean out, which is something that sometimes happens when people who hoard are contacted by governmental agencies. And so, you know, the original story had hints of what the full story was.
Okay, well, let's maybe drive to the heart of this, really, which is that she comes from a working class immigrant family that is in and around the steel industry, from a town which was the site of one of the biggest, if not the biggest, actual labor battle, you know, between hired thugs hired by basically Frick and Carnegie, who set themselves upon strikers at the Homestead Mills. I mean, it's a huge labor battle in 1893. And she herself, she has this aspiration, right, which is to achieve as an academic and to become a professor, which she sort of half becomes. In fact, because there is kind of a half union acting on her behalf, she gets caught in this academic purgatory because she doesn't have a PhD. What did you conclude about that world in which she found herself? Should we consider her lucky to have gotten as far as she did, given the fact that she didn't have a doctorate and given her, you know, supposedly humble origins? Or should we look at it as a kind of purgatory, as a you know, highly exploited zone in which universities kind of get the milk for free, as it were?
I think absolutely the latter. You know, Professor Brodko didn't have her PhD, but she was obviously a devoted teacher and a very intelligent woman. And if universities are willing to employ people to teach undergraduates, they should acknowledge that that is serious work. I mean, the question is, like, do we think that that teaching at a college level is a profession worthy of respect and the kinds of things that we tend to get from jobs, benefits and job security and a living wage? And I think most people would say yes. And the fact that universities are now relying primarily on adjuncts, people who are making very, very little money, as I write in my piece, it's a scourge. And I think that what universities are taking advantage of is that you have people who are really, really devoted to teaching, like Professor Boitko. And also people, this was not necessarily the case with Professor Boitko, but there are many adjuncts who would like to become tenured professor someday. And they've been told sort of that, like, this is the path to a tenure track job is adjuncting. But in fact, it's sort of a dead end. When you're an adjunct, you don't have time to do research, to publish articles. It really is like it's a second class citizenship kind of thing. And, you know, the question is education a higher good? I think most people would say yes. I think that, you know, the society depends on people being educated. And I think that one of the biggest hypocrisies that we see in this story is that, you know, we're asking people to pay enormous amounts in tuition to go to college, and yet we can't even pay the people who are teaching them as much as a single student is paying in tuition for a whole year. It's just, like, incredibly unbalanced.
I think that's one of the things that's somewhat perplexing about the university resistance to unionization, at least in my sort of casual news reading of these subjects. I mean, when you think about industries like airlines and auto workers and their fights against unions, you can fall on whatever side of the political spectrum you want to. But when you read those stories, you can't help but notice those are failing, dying industries that are starved for profits, and that the economic realities that made strong unions possible changed. The notion that there's a reckoning in the auto industry or a reckoning in the airline industry around unions makes sense, however you think politically that should fall out. In universities, because typically they're not-for-profit institutions, because their finances are often more opaque, although it varies from university to university, it's harder to me to see how universities even defend these positions.
Right. And, you know, Duquesne is a special case. Duquesne is arguing that it does not have to recognize its adjuncts union because it is a religious institution. And there are various reasons that claim looks incredibly spurious, among them the fact that, you know, if you go to Duquesne, it doesn't mean that you're Catholic. You're not required to be Catholic to be a student or to be a teacher. You know, teachers are allowed to say whatever they want about Catholicism in the classroom. It looks like an incredibly cynical attempt just to avoid having to pay their adjuncts more money.
Plus, you noted in your piece that multiple popes have espoused labor unions, which I was not aware of.
Oh, yeah. It's Catholic social teaching is very unambiguous on the question of unions, and the Catholic Church has traditionally supported unions. So it's like many, many layers of hypocrisy in Duquesne's resistance to unionization.
You know, I was struck, Laura, by the way that in your piece you explored Duquesne's defense of their treatment of Margaret Mary Boitko and the way that they sort of use her problems, her arguable mental illness and her, you know, inability to, for example, finish her dissertation or keep her workspace neat. I mean, in many ways, she was a very difficult employee, especially as she got older. And so in a way, that is a part of their defense, as well as, you know, explaining the various acts of charity and people's attempts to reach out to her, which she refused. So it is a more complicated story than simply an elderly woman being exploited until she falls dead in the street, as it was reported by this earliest piece. But at the same time, I really like the way that your investigation brings those two things together and makes you see how the exploitive nature of the institution might particularly prey on individuals like Mary Margaret Boitko, that there might be sort of smart people on the fringes of academia who can't quite get it together to become that tenure-track professor, but who nonetheless devote their lives to teaching, and that the system is really set up to just mine people like that for everything they've got.
So, Laura, what I'm curious by way of wrapping up, I mean, this was a very nuanced and very specific case, right? But that nonetheless, you discovered, you know, that the system is in some ways broken. Is one of the, so if the villain isn't, you know, if Margaret Mary isn't necessarily a spotless hero and the university isn't an uncomplicated villain, is in some ways U.S. News and World Report driving some of what's breaking the system? In other words, universities are now in a arms race with one another for nicer gyms, for, you know, fancier dorms, for things that will attract candidates. And they all know, it's now come out in several instances. In fact, they falsify some numbers. They all know which measurables they're going to be rated on in that one survey, which is determinative for many prospective students. And teaching tends to be an immeasurable, right? Would one way to solve this problem be to somehow bake into the U.S. News survey, you know, number of percentage of adjuncts, percentage of PhDs, percentage of tenure track professors, so that it's not easy for a university to skimp radically on this while they put in, you know, new Nautilus machines every 5 years?
I think that's a great idea. I think that if, you know, I think we're starting to see with stories like Professor Boyko's that the problem of universities' over-reliance on adjuncts is becoming common knowledge. And the more that's common knowledge, I think the more that people will be able to maybe choose their college based on whether they're going to be getting tenured professors or adjunct professors. And I do think that the U.S. News and World Report rankings are, at the very least, a symptom of the larger problem, which is that you have private and public universities relying more and more on tuition in order to keep themselves running. And so that means families who can afford to pay full tuition instead of families who are getting some kind of grant or scholarship. And that means, yes, it's becoming more and more of a consumer transaction. Universities are becoming more and more like, you know, spas in which you have, like you said, a beautiful gym or beautiful facilities. And like you are attracting students based on those amenities. Yeah, it's like the corporatization of the university is the phrase that is frequently used to describe this larger problem. And certainly U.S. News and World Reports is a part of that.
Well, Laura Anderson's piece is called Death of a Professor, an 83-year-old French instructor's undignified death becomes a cause celeb for exploited academics. Laura, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's a tremendous piece and people should really seek it out.
Thanks, Steve.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our program where we endorse. Dana Stevens, what do you got?
Well, I'm in the middle of reading this fantastic book called The Riddle of the Labyrinth by Marguerite Fox. Are you guys familiar with Marguerite Fox, the greatest obit writer for the New York Times?
Oh, that's where I know that name from.
Yeah. Anytime, this is how I discovered her. Anytime you read an obituary in the New York Times that's particularly beautifully wrought and fascinating and gets at exactly what was so interesting about that person's life, you look at the byline and it's Marguerite Fox. So I started following her on Twitter and I saw that she had a book, a new book, or it was a few months ago, I guess, called The Riddle of the Labyrinth, which is about a very me topic, about the decipherment of an ancient script. And it's really, really fascinating. So it's the story of the decipherment of Linear B, which was this script that was discovered on the Greek island of Crete in 1900, and nobody knew what language it was from. Nobody knew what culture it was from. All they knew was, you know, we have these ancient tablets with these symbols on them, and it took 50 or more years for the symbols to be deciphered. So this is the story of all the various savants who had a crack at the Linear B script, including a fascinating female classicist named Alice Kober. So it sort of turns into her story. Anyway, I'm right in the midst of it, but it's just beautiful writing and a great, juicy, real-life story about code cracking.
Wow.
Wow, sounds... Yeah, sounds very cool. All right. Well, Julia Turner, what do you got?
I have to offer an autumnal strut. This song has just been blaring out of my computer for a week because it is so propulsive and awesome. So if you need to bring some summer strut into your pre-holiday errands and hullabaloo, you should listen to the song Black Belt by the musician John Grant, and it is off his album Pale Green Ghosts. I can't even describe it. If we can just bring up the music, you will all know its power.
We need it in our outro, obviously.
My inner beat goes on.
Well, there we go. Okay, well, so as everyone probably who's listened to this show for any period of time can tell you, I could tiresomely re-endorse three things over and over and over again.
Wait, I want Dana and I to guess them before you do it. It's some poem by Robert Frost.
You said an emo Scandinavian band.
Yeah, Jens Lehmann. And then some kind of academic polemic.
No. Then some kind of food that's only available within a 5-mile radius of your house.
All right, endorse whatever you're endorsing.
So the three things that I had written down here were the short French movie La Jetée, which is used to be available on YouTube. I think now you got to pay a couple bucks on iTunes for it. Pi from the Pi Stand, which actually I can refresh that endorsement one more time because Greenacres Pi Stand in Livingston, New York, we were just so pied out. We brought their bread and some of their other baked products. They're so good, man. They're the best. But the other thing I could re-endorse until, you know, basically the sun snuffed itself out was the BBC radio show and podcast Start the Week, whose host is Andrew Marr, who suffered a stroke and was seriously debilitated and was not on the show for a period of at least a year, maybe longer. And Andrew Marr, I am so pleased to report, has returned to Start the Week.
He's on this week's show? Because I just heard last week and he wasn't back
yet. I don't know if this is his first week. I had taken a couple weeks off. I kind of queued him up and listened to the most recent one first. So he may have been back for more than a week, but he is definitely back on Start the Week. It is so comforting and so heartening to hear his voice. He is absolutely the best host of anything who ever lived. And I mean that actually seriously. And you can tell, I've never met him, but you can tell from listening to him, he's a wonderful person as well. I'm so psyched that he's back. So my endorsement this week is La Jetée, Pi, the hatefulness of my co-hosts, belittling way in which they regard me, and the BBC podcast Start the Week and the return of its great host, Andrew Marr. All right. Well, thank you, Dana.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, or in the newly updated WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Sally Herships, Chris Wade, and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf, and we'll talk to you next week.
What you got is a black belt in BS, but you can't hawk your pretty wares up in here anymore. Hit your head on the playground at recess, etch a sketch your way out of this one reject.